Yeah, so I was just saying that given there's a talk at 11, I'll just introduce myself. I'm Mihaela Zavon. I work at the Biozentrum in Basel. And I'm also part of the Swiss Institute of Bioinformatics. And for the since 2002 or so, when I've been at Rockefeller, I started working with Tom Tuschl on microRNAs. And the stuff that I'm going to tell you about, also considering that the post-transcriptional week is just going to start next week, is somewhat of a personal but a bit more sort of higher-level view of what I've done, the kind of topics I've touched on. And mostly, it's all sort of focused on computational aspects of research in microRNAs. It doesn't include targets, so it's all related to microRNA identification and expression profiling. So I started, I mean, just to put the flashy title, I called it microRNomics. The term RNomics, as far as I know, has been coined by Alex Judenhofer, and it actually started from the field of snow RNAs. So although most of the people now that are doing RNomics are working really with microRNAs, or things close to microRNAs, actually this field has, or the term RNomics itself has been coined by people doing research on snow RNAs. So what does it entail, basically? The game is, if you just were to take total RNA, labeled RNA, and run it on a gel, then you get to see these kind of bands here that come up at different lengths. And in particular, I've just marked some things. So microRNAs are very short sequences, 21, 23 nucleotides in length. Slightly higher here, you will start seeing the snow RNAs, the tRNAs, and another class of snow RNAs. And basically, the whole game of RNomics is to try to figure out what other classes of small RNAs are in this interval here. And as you notice, if you just do total RNA and you do gels on this, you won't see very much. So you see a clear band of tRNAs that are very abundant. So I guess one of the reasons why this has been, this field has gotten such a boost now is that there are a lot of things in here which are rather difficult to see. Some of them are less abundant, and you have to do special things to pick them up. I'll get into that in a second. Okay, so special things to pick them up. Well, first of all, what you can do is to isolate the right kind of samples, right? So if you look, for example, here in an adult testis, there's a class of small RNAs, which are called fire RNAs. I'll talk a bit about them later. They have a length around 27, 29 nucleotides, and they only come up at a specific developmental stage. You can also do other things like put a probe that labels a specific microRNA sequence, and then you would see a band over here. But in the absence of such manipulations, these small RNAs are really difficult to see. So what kind of things people found? So as I said, the first one in this paper actually talks mostly about snow RNAs. There are two classes of them. One is mostly 60 nucleotides long, the other one around 120. And their function, as far as we know it, is to direct the modification of ribosomal RNAs. So they hybridize with ribosomal RNAs, and specific positions in those hybrids are going to acquire methyl groups or uridyl groups. A lot of the snow RNAs were known before. What is new going on about these snow RNAs is that people now have started to find a lot of snow RNAs for which they cannot find the ribosomal RNA target. So there are clusters of snow RNAs, and particularly they occur on some specific chromosomes, frequently expressed very specifically like in brain. And as far as we can tell by doing hybridization, the sort of computational prediction of hybrids and things like that, we cannot find the ribosomal RNA target. So the question now is, what do these do? There's one paper at least last year that showed that the snow RNA seems to be directing the alternative splicing of a gene. The class that I think has received most of attention is the microRNAs, and I'll talk a lot more about this today. In 2002, the group of David Bartel has identified a class of small RNAs that seem to function in silencing the centromeric repeat. So this term actually is coming from Tom Tuschl, but it's referring to things like this, repeat-associated small interfering RNAs. And as you notice here, in contrast to the microRNAs that function by interacting with mRNA sequences, so post-transcriptionally, these brassiRNAs seem to silence central mirroring repeats at the DNA level. So far, these things have been convincingly found in this paper in fish and yeast, and there are some other studies in Drosophila where things like that seem to function, but in mammals, I don't think there is any convincing study yet. And this is a new player in the game. PiRNAs, again, I'll talk about them a little bit today. So these things are expressed specifically in male germ cells, and at the moment, we don't really know what they do. There are some hypotheses. Okay, so this is my one slide about post-transcriptional regulation. As I said, I know you have a lot of tutorials in the coming weeks, but I just want to introduce the class of microRNAs that I'm going to talk mostly about. So microRNAs come from endogenous genes. So in the nucleus, in the DNA, we have these things which are called microRNA genes. Sometimes they are independent. Sometimes they're actually part of the introns of other genes. They seem to form these hairpin structures. And that structure is important for recognition by a whole lot of different complexes that process the microRNA. So the first step in the nucleus is from a relatively long, sometimes even if they're independent genes, they can be spliced and they can be kilobases long. So from such a long transcript in the nucleus, a complex that includes the Drosha enzyme comes and cuts the simple hairpin loops, which are called pre-microRNAs. These are picked up by an export mechanism, exporting 5, and taken into the cytoplasm, where the complex that includes the dipeptide enzyme comes and removes this terminal loop and produces a double-stranded RNA. Typically, one of the two strands, in the case of microRNAs, or both strands, actually, in the case of the siRNAs, can be picked up by the complex, the RISC complex that includes the organelle protein, and then they go together in this complex to bind to mRNA, something like this, imperfect base pairing, and direct either the cleavage or the translational silencing of mRNA. This pathway, or at least a part of this pathway, is used in the RNAi, by the RNAi processes. So if you have viral RNA sequences or double-stranded RNAs that are introduced from outside by transfection or other mechanisms, C. elegans, they actually can eat this double-stranded RNA. It's actually only Dicer in the cytoplasm that comes and chops this thing up at 22 nucleotides intervals and produces these small interfering RNAs, which through the RISC complex go and perfectly bind with perfect complementarity to mRNAs, and those mRNAs are going to be degraded. So that's how RNAi works. Today, I'm going to talk about this. How did microRNA gene discovery actually evolve? And again, this is a very, so this is how I view it. I'm sure you're going to hear a different account next week. So the founder of this class is the LIN4 RNA, which binds to the LIN14 protein 3' UTR, and it induces the translational silencing of this protein. So when LIN4 comes up, LIN14 goes down, and this process is involved in lineage specification in C. elegans, so these pictures you have seen before. This is an old picture, actually. I picked up this from the Swarm book, about which you've heard again this past week. This is a relatively old picture. This microRNA has been discovered in the early 90s, and people generally thought that this was something odd to C. elegans or maybe a couple of worms. Things started going, actually, with the discovery of the LET7 microRNA, the second microRNA in worm, which also has the same kind of function of translationally inhibiting the expression of the LIN4-41 protein, which is involved in the same lineage specification pathway. And these microRNAs notice that the way they've been discovered is by classical genetics. So people have isolated mutants, they've figured out what the gene locus was, they found that it's actually a small RNA, and they have, by this process, because you know what the mutant looks like, the moment you've discovered the microRNA, you actually have a function associated with it. This is important because This is not the case for most microneedles that we know today, and I'll tell you why. Now, things, yeah. That's probably one reason. I think another reason is probably the fly people don't really talk to the worm people, and so, you know, there's things that are known in different fields, and they're discovering, I mean, the whole history of RNAi, if you look at who actually ever discovered RNAi, aside from the people that got the Nobel Prize today. Okay, so, in contrast to LEN4, what is really spectacular about LEN7 is that if you look, so here I've put an alignment of LEN7 microRNA, actually it has many family members in human, but one of them aligned to a whole lot of other species, and you have here human, chimp, dog, mouse, chicken, fishes, flies, worms, all these things. And this is a perfectly conserved microRNA, right? So why this thing is cool is because when this picture sort of emerged in the literature, then you can, people started figuring out, well, okay, we have all these genomes, now we can do computational genomics, right? So there are basically sort of two approaches that were started by this discovery. So first of all, people figured out that it's probably general. It's very conserved from worms to humans, so it's worth trying to do experiments to find more of these things. This is what I call the experiment-driven approach to finding microRNAs, and that involves cloning a lot of these sequences. And then because it's conserved, a lot of computational people figured out, well, we can do comparative genomics and find these things. And that's the computationally driven approach. Basically, both of these things are high throughput approaches. They involve, to some extent, experimentation, to some extent, computational analysis at different levels. And the outcome of this is that actually from... Yeah. I'll get to that. Okay, so that basically made... So in 2001, there were four papers on microRNAs. In 2006, I've just done a PubMed search, there's close to 600 papers on microRNAs. And so to come back to what I mentioned before, in contrast to this approach here, where the moment you found your small RNA, you actually have a function for it, you can imagine that all these things are just sequences, and people really don't know what they are, and the game now is to try to figure out what the functions are. So how does this, so I'm going to have to defer to that. So I want to tell you about the computational driven approach a little bit at the beginning, and I'll get into the experimental one, and then I'll tell you exactly how you get these sequences, okay? Okay, computational approaches. So I'll start with telling you what exactly it is that I've done, and then I'll go a little bit through other methods that have been used to discover small RNA. So it all starts with this picture again. If you, what I told you at the beginning is that there are these prime microRNAs in the nucleus. There's a hairpin that forms there. Presumably, Drosha seems to be recognizing these hairpins, cuts these individual ones. They are transported by X14-5 that also seems to hook up to a hairpin structure. They go into the cytoplasm, but Dicer also picks this thing up. It's again a hairpin, and it cuts the small RNA. So if you want to find microRNAs, the main clue is that if you look in the genome, in the region that surrounds the 22 nucleotide long thing, you can extract such a region and fold it, and you get hairpins. Now, the problem is that a lot of other genomic regions form hairpins, and there are, according to some people, not all of those are microRNAs. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is the LEN7 microRNAs, sort of the minimal hairpins, and this is just a fragment that I picked up when doing my computational searches. If you look at this, it just looks as beautiful as a hairpin as this one, and probably even better than the one that corresponds to a real microRNA 147. So hairpin structure is not the only thing that makes a microRNA. So what people do is to find other criteria that that they can use to filter out the false positives. And one very typical one is to use evolutionary information. This picture is from a paper by Eric Lai, where they found microRNA in Drosophila species. So what this shows you is basically a genome alignment of Melanogaster pseudobscura. And what you see here on the y-axis is some measure of conservation. And this particular region here that shows a peak in conservation, if you isolate it, it's a sequence over here, if all that forms this hairpin, and the sequence, the subsequence highlighted in red here is this mature form of microRNA 184. State of art. So the RNA folding people like Ivo Hofacker and Peter Stadler tell me that things that are maybe 500 to 600, they still believe, and beyond that, they don't.
But they still believe all the way to 500.
Yes.
More like
500. Well, the shorter the better, of course. But with these things, you don't have this problem because they're, I think the longest are maybe 120 or so. But yeah, a few hundred. They believe, and it depends also what kind of structures you look for. So these ones are very stable. They should be stable. So if you get such a thing, you probably believe it. If you look for a short stem loop, then yeah, that's going to change depending on the context.
I think it's a question of the specific type of what, right? You can follow the 519 and you take one of these loops in it, and you now use it for the type of smaller something, you still can get the stem loop. Do you believe the whole structure of the whole
5 sigmas out. Okay, so I think these things, they do come up in various contexts. So in particular, there's a study that I'll mention a bit later. They look at how significant the energy of the microRNA stems is compared to randomized ones. And they found that there's, value, typically less than 1%, right? So these kind of things are done. The M-fold, not so much, but the Vienna-fold actually does compute the partition function. So you can look for specific substructures and see how, what fraction of the ensemble you can see them in and things like that. But I guess that's depending a lot on what you want to do with the program. What we do is, I'll get to that, is we don't actually just take any hairpin, but we look at hairpins that are stable if you shift the sequence because, as I mentioned before, this hairpin has to be stable in the context of the 8KB transcript as well as the very short thing. So what we do is we take windows that are overlapping this thing and we look for stems that are stable no matter how you shift the window. But yeah, you have to do things like that because even if you have a short piece, you can't trust the
piece. And I guess I was wondering that to locate the substructure like that,
well, I shouldn't take sides here. I use Vienna fold because I think it's fast, it's easy, the outputs are easily processable as far as I can tell, and all the functions that I need, they provide. They do also co-folding and other things. If you see these kind of pictures, I typically generate them with M-fold because it puts a lot more time into actually visualizing. Okay. So this is one way you can try to filter out false positives. Now the problem is, as I told you at the beginning, I started working on microRNAs, I ended up working on viral microRNAs. And the problem with these is that they're really poorly conserved. So I'm showing you here one actually very good example. At the time when I've done this kind of prediction, we didn't have all these viral microRNA stems that I'm showing you here. So this is one microRNA in the Epstein-Barr virus. This is the one you see here. So every single line that goes like this is a hairpin loop corresponding to a autologous microRNA sequence. In the middle, there's the consensus. This is the human virus. This is the, these are basically three monkey viruses, and these are autologous sequences. Yes. These are the homologous viruses in various kinds of monkeys. Okay. So at the time when we've done this, yes. At the time when we've done this, actually, these viruses were not sequenced. So we only had the human virus, and we had a whole bunch of human herpes viruses, Kaposi sarcoma, Epstein-Barr, cytomegalic virus, all these things. So this example that I'm showing you here is really autologous sequences of a viral microRNA. And as you can see, I've marked here the mature forms. This microRNA expresses, this precursor expresses microRNAs from both arms. I mark the mature forms, and you can see that they're, even at the mature form level, they're not very well conserved. And this is in the homologous viruses from monkeys. It's not going from Epstein-Barr to Kaposi sarcoma virus, where you cannot see any conservation at all.
So, do you actually know or think that this virus is something that was already a virus of the common ancestors of us, you know, monkeys?
Well, these are related viruses. They, some form of an ancestor of them existed in the ancestors of the monkeys.
Well, it could be
I don't think I know enough virology to make a very strong statement about that.
Well, we think it's basically an older virus that goes back over like the ancestors of old species, and that now we have to look for the virus, or that maybe
there are, they are
from and
they are old viruses. You also have this kind of virus. I mean,
yes,
there is some kind of a mixture of a
virus, and you know the virus has such a short lifetime that it don't persist for such a long time.
No. Well, yes and no. I guess these are DNA, these are long DNA viruses, and they are fairly stable. I mean, if you look at RNA viruses, you can't tell, but these are DNA viruses with long genomes. They're fairly stable.
I would not be interested in the next talk. In regard to the
okay.
And the viruses and the
perfect. Okay. So the point was, viral microRNAs are not very well conserved, especially at the stage we did this. We could not find homologous this microRNA in other viruses. This was discovered experimentally, and the question came, of course, what other viruses express microRNAs, but we could not just simply do homology mapping of these microRNAs because you can't find. So we had to come up with some method that can actually work on a single species, and I'll tell you about our method. Works like this. So first of all, we try to identify stem loops in the viral genomes, and I'm talking about these robust stem loops, so I'll tell you how I find them in a minute. And I think that we wanted to do, and this was rather new, as I'll mention when I'm going through the other methods, is to actually make a model from positive and negative. So we also take into account what is not, most likely not a microRNA. This was sort of mentioned before, actually, in a talk about transcription factors, sort of the contrasting things that are binding sites versus non-binding sites, and we think that this really gives you extra information. And then we, of course, want to classify the stem loops used in this model. So how do we detect these robust stem loops that form stable structures? What you see here is the microRNA 100, and what we've done is we've taken regions that are that surround this precursor sequence of different lengths. So here is 200 nucleotides flanking on the 5' end, 200 flanking on the 3' end, or 50-50, or 350. And this is just to show you that there is this little piece over here that forms exactly the same structure no matter how, what kind of context you pick. So this is how we identify robust stem loops. We basically take the viral genome, it goes with a window of, windows of different lengths over it, and we identify in the end pieces that form exactly the same structure in all the windows that, or some fraction of the windows that go over that region. Now, this is obviously not enough. So if you just look in the EBZ genome, what you see, robust envelopes here of roughly the same kind of length as microRNAs, you get about one in, I think, 100 or so, or one in 1,000, right? So it's about a few hundred, 200 or so per strand of genome in a virus that has about 160, 200 kilobases. So we have to do more. So we have to actually classify them. So this is where we use the support vector machine. So for this, we need positive and negative examples to train the model. And for the positives, we had about 120, I think, human microRNAs known at the time. They look something like this. They form this kind of hairpin. And for negatives, we took anything that could form these robust stem loops just the same as we've done for microRNA precursors. And these things included pieces of mRNAs, ribosomal RNAs, tRNAs, and pieces of the viral genome, because of course we want to find these things in viral genomes. We have to take into account the sequence composition in there. And then we start defining a whole bunch of features, and I'm not going to go through them because it's not very important, but so just to tell you what kind of features we made up. Things like the length of the stem, the free energy of folding, the distance between the loops, the symmetry of the loop. So by that I mean if you have this kind of an internal loop in a stem, how many bases are there on one side, how many bases on the other. It turns out that from people actually knew before, it seems that asymmetrical loops of this kind, where you have two bases on one side, one on the other, or many more on one side, one on the other, these things are infrequent in microRNA precursors. So based on things like this, we made up a model. Well, it's the same holds for all these other things. The negatives, we never know precisely that they're negatives. The only assumption is that there's, in the negatives, there's a much lower fraction that could be microRNAs and then screw up your model. But the assumption we make is that these microRNAs are really, really uncommon in whatever you think you take. Well, I just mentioned before, something like 200 on one strand, 200 on another, so a few hundred. So around 400 in total, yeah. I'll get to that. So there may be I'm on the conservative side of the estimate of microRNA. So what is known now for EBV is maybe sort of 15 or so, 16 microRNAs in the whole genome. I mean, actually not the one that I'm showing you here, because that one only has 5. But it's a smaller fraction of the robust stems that we have. There are, but the thing to understand here is that we are starting at a place where if you just predict stems, even if you predict sort of symmetrical stems and all these kind of things, you get hundreds of these things in viral genomes. We don't think that all those are microRNAs, and what we wanted to do is to have a method that could very quickly tell us which viruses are likely to have microRNAs, which ones don't. Yeah, because they're processed by the same machinery. That's the assumption here, too. Thank you. have not looked at the robust N distribution across things like the human genome. I'm sure that that varies, and I'm sure that there are a lot of positives in the negatives that I'm reporting. I mean, I know that because if I check with the non-microRNAs, about 60% of them, I get 67, depending on how I do it, but the other ones I don't. And I know that, and I as I said, so the point of this is to be as conservative as possible because we're going to do experiments downstream, and I want to be sure that what I say is a microRNA is a microRNA. And then, I mean, you can always look at the other ones if you want to, but that wasn't the goal. Okay, so this is just to tell you so how the support vector machines work. I don't know if many of you probably know. So you have a vector of a high-dimensional vector of features, and what the support vector machine does is to find a separating hyperplane between the things that are labeled positives and the things that are labeled negative, such that you make minimal error. And that's what we've done here, and this is the classification that we end up with on the training set. So basically, you get as I said, around 30% false negatives, 3% false positives. So there's a lot of microRNAs that are not classified as microRNAs, but the error rate, at least in the viral genomes, is manageable because here I know that I get a few hundred stems per viral genome. It's not very likely that those are not microRNAs. So features like the length of the stem, the energy of the stem, the number of base pairs of different kinds, the number of nucleotides of different kinds, the length of these longest symmetrical regions in the stem and stuff like that. They're all, I guess, in the paper. But. Okay. So here's what we get. Somewhere between 30 and 40, closer to 40. A fair amount, I guess, if we look at the region, so we look at a bunch of features that are computed over the longest symmetrical region, and also for the longest slightly asymmetrical region that is allowed to have some asymmetrical volume, so there should be overlap in there. But we haven't tried to optimize this to make it sort of minimal number of features and so on. Okay, so these are the viruses that we've tried. And the only thing I want to show you here is that here's the genome length, here's the number of predicted, these are the circles, and the number of cloned microRNAs are these squares, and in parentheses you see the overlap. And I should just tell you that roughly we get basically sort of 50% false positive, 50% false negative. It's actually better than we have it here because in the Epstein-Barr virus, we actually did the prediction on a virus that has a long deletion where it looks like there's 10 extra microRNAs, which we mostly predict. But here we predicted, 7 or so, and the overlap with the known ones was 3. Okay, and the reason for showing you this is just to say that we don't think we're just making predictions of false positives. It would maybe go linear with the genome size because obviously the number of predictions doesn't go linear with the genome size. And another thing to note is that all these viruses here are DNA herpes viruses. And for some of them we do make predictions and for some of them we don't. And so far as I know, there's some, so in these ones that we cloned, we know that there are microRNAs. In this herpes simplex viruses, there are also microRNAs, but nobody has yet cloned microRNAs from these others. Right. So the point was to do to have some guidelines of what viruses should be cloned microRNA from to find them. And we said, okay, so we should clone from these ones here. And there are problems with cloning from these ones because of their life cycle and so on. But these ones that could be actually cloned, they've done it and they found the microRNA. And actually there are some, so if you see here, there's a BK virus. This is a family of the SV40 viruses, small DNA viruses. We make one prediction here, and we've done this also for some homologs of this, and other people have found this independently, and they've shown that that particular microRNA is involved in regulating the interaction with the immune system. So applied to viruses, we think it works pretty well. As I said, it's not perfect, near perfect, but it works. So we used it to find basically up to last year pretty much all the microRNAs that were known. right now, because of the Epstein-Barr ones and the homologs in other monkey viruses and so on, there's more. A couple of words on mRNA gene prediction in general. So just to mention that there are some other methods. HIV, no. This one. You're going to find out about herpes virus evolution, maybe. I don't think there's a lot of lateral transfer between these ones, and they have relatively different AT content and different tropism and stuff like that. They're not, I mean, it is surprising that for some of them we make predictions, for some of them we make none. But as I said, as far as I know, nobody has found yet mRNAs in these ones. And because it's, I mean, these are all herpes viruses, they're related viruses, and if you compare the mRNAs of this one and this one, there is no similarity, so it looks like they do evolve very fast. So, but by the same token, they appear and they disappear, so. Okay, mRNA gene prediction. So the first method that I know of was, it came from Chris Burgess' lab, and this is actually very similar to what I mentioned before. So they take stem loops and they have a bunch of features like the conservation, so they do it based on conservation. So they have some 3' conservation of the mature form, 5' conservation of the mature form, what precisely the initial pentamer of the mRNA is, the distance from the loop, the base pairing and all kinds of things. So basically it's the same idea to have a set of features and you use them to calculate the score, and each feature has a weight associated with it, and this is given here, and they just basically sort of guessed or fitted this weight. And the main difference between this method and what I've told you before is that this is really looking at mRNA stems and computing these features based on them, and it's not really trying to contrast positives and negatives. And again, it's using the conservation criteria, which we haven't used before. So they've made predictions of, taken all the stems from a whole lot of genomes, and this is the distribution of scores, and they fixed their score threshold such that they basically get 50% of the known mRNAs at the time. And all of the rest are made, are presumed to be predictions. Another variation on this theme. So this is a snapshot from the genome browser. I'll get to that too, yes. Let me just try to sort of, because, all right. So if you look in the genome browser, this is a mRNA, and you look at other species, you can see that there's relatively strong conservation, and in particular, there's some conservation pattern for mRNA genes. The mature form, which is this thicker line over here, is typically conserved in a bunch of species. There's slightly less conservation in the foldback arm, and less conservation in the hairpin loop. So a group from the Netherlands, what they've done is they've taken these kind of genome alignments, they looked for this kind of conservation pattern, then they've taken the regions of the regions for the length that they believe could be a mRNA precursor, they folded those, they found these stem loops. And now to weed out the things that are, again, false positives and stems that don't really fold stably, they've used this idea of randomization. So this is from another paper. And what these people have done is they've taken structures from tRNAs, ribosomal RNAs, microRNAs, and so on, and they folded those and computed the energy. And then they've done randomizations of different kinds, preserving the mononucleotide frequency, using the Markov model built from the input sequences, dinucleotide randomization. And what you see here is the fraction of sequences that have a p-value less than 0.05, 0.01, 0.001, right? So these different columns for the different kinds of, at different cutoffs, basically, so if you look at p-value less than 0.05, if you do a mononucleotide randomization, basically 98% of the mRNAs have a p-value less than that. So based on this kind of statistical argument, you can take this stem over here, you generate random variants, and if this stem loop has a p-value less than 0.01 or so, you say, okay, this I trust it. So they made predictions like that, and I'll get to how many predictions they made also in a second. A rather bold approach was taken by Eric Lander's group, and it looks like this. So here's a hybrid of one microRNA that I think has not yet been isolated. The lousy thick microRNA C. elegans that is targeting this COG1 gene. And the 5' end of the microRNA pairs perfectly with the 3' UTR of the gene. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I think it's just that this occurs in a very, very restricted population of neurons. It's hard to actually get it experimentally. It has? Okay. All right, the point is that the 5' end of the microRNA tends to be perfectly paired with the target sequence. And if you look in, so this is yet another microRNA, here are genome alignments of UTRs, and I'm showing you here a number of predicted target sites for the LAD7 microRNA. And as you can see, if you take genome alignments from human down to chicken, very frequently these things are conserved. So what Eric Lander's group has done is to take look at octamers in 3' UTRs, and you look at all the octamers in all the human 3' UTRs, and you look at which ones of them are perfectly conserved all the way down to dog in, I don't know, 5 or so species they have. So these would be predicted 5' ends of microRNAs, right? So now you look at where these octamers, the complement of these octamers occurs in the genome, and you can take a region around there and fold it and check if it forms a hairpin loop. So this is basically the hairpin loop corresponding to the LAD7 microRNA, and this is one novel microRNA that they've discovered this way. So they went from the target perspective, they picked up what they think is a 5' end of a microRNA, 8 nucleotides, they mapped those to the genome, the reverse complement of that to the genome, taken the surrounding region, found if they form hairpin loops, and are those more or less conserved as well. Is the mature form more or less conserved, because you know where the beginning of it is, because you know that this is really position 1 to 8, what you're looking for. And this is how they've predicted a whole lot of new microRNAs. In which one? This one. This one. I guess so. But the mature form is really here. So the region that corresponds to the mature form is perfectly base pair. So it's just the beginning. It starts in a loop and it ends in a loop. But over the mature microRNA sequence, it is. And so these are just, I've just given you a cross section of what I think are methods that are really different in the approach. And there's now a lot of others, in particular using support vector machines with all kinds of different features that you can go and read about. Okay, so I'll try to tell you a bit about the experimental driven approaches. How does it work? It's a very good question. So this is a slide again that I've taken from Tom Tuschel. Here's the protocol for isolating the small RNA. So from total RNA, somewhere in the total RNA in the right size fraction, so what they do is they take the total RNA, they put it on the gel, they cut the piece that corresponds to roughly 20 nucleotides. In there should be microRNAs, and they have a special property in that their 5' end contains a phosphate group. And this is important for how they actually do the adapter ligation in such a way that you enrich for things that have a 5' phosphate group. And that allows you to basically, if you look at the end of what comes out, typically 60%, sometimes even 80% of all the sequences that you get in there are microRNAs. Okay, so there's a small RNA, then they have some enzyme that really puts blunt ligation of adaptive sequences like this. Then they reverse transcribe these, they frequently concatenomerize them because it's easier to sequence longer pieces, and then you get things that look like this. So this is a cDNA now, where the adapters I've marked with blue, and the small RNAs are these pieces in between, which I've marked with black, and these are presumably in there, there are microRNAs. So this adapter removal and everything that comes downstream up to the point where you get the report with what kind of sequences you have, this is all done computationally. we have a pool of sequences like this. What we do is we try to figure out what is known in there, and we do that basically by comparing with sequences of known functions. So we constructed databases of things that we know are ribosomal, tRNA, known microRNAs, and so on. We search these things against the database, and then we figure out what is known. And then typically the stuff that is left that is unknown, if I get to it, I'll tell you in a minute, but first I want to just go through what you can learn about microRNAs just from doing this exercise, taking the small RNAs, figuring out which ones map to microRNAs, and then analyzing these sequences. Yeah? You see a lot of things that, I mean, you can even see ribosomal RNA fragments, you can see tRNA fragments, all these kind of things you see. Now, people don't really know what they mean. Are they really just sort of noise? They end up in risk for some reason, or they're picked up just from the total RNA for some reason that is not known. And a lot of people actually believe that some of those might be microRNAs, even though they're low frequency. Okay, so how many microRNAs do we get in a cell or in a tissue? So all this analysis and these sort of questions that I'm going to try to answer are based on a study that Tom Tuschel has done over the past 3 years, and I've analyzed all the data. So I just try to give you some snippets of what we think we've learned about microRNAs from this study. Okay, so it's an interesting question. Are there microRNAs really specific for a particular cell type, so that you have, you know, one particular microRNA expressed in muscle and another one expressed in nervous system or not? So the question that I've asked here is, if you say, okay, for every sample we basically get the count for every known microRNA, how many sequences from that microRNA we've seen in that particular sample? So I call those, each microRNA is a microRNA type, and what you see here is a histogram of how many samples have, if I call a microRNA exists in a sample, that means it has at least one copy in the sample, or it has at least five copies in the sample. So if you just look at sequences and say everything that is in at least one copy is a microRNA that is expressed in the tissue, then you see, you know, typically samples have around 70 or so microRNA types. Now if you say, well, it has to have some reasonable frequency that is not really noise, I want to just have at least five copies from that sample, then that number drops dramatically. So it goes to about 35 or so microRNAs if you require at least five copies. So from any sample, you can find a lot of microRNAs, but most of them are going to be low expressed, and I'll get to that again. If you ask the question, what is the frequency of the most abundant microRNA in a sample? So what proportion of the sample was this particular microRNA? And I just look at the top one. So there are some microRNAs like 122 in the liver, 142 in lymphocytes that are really very abundant in that particular cell type, right? So 80% of the 75% of the liver microRNAs is really only microRNA 122. But most of the samples have the top microRNAs, maybe, you know, 20% of all the microRNA population. So there's a lot of variety in these populations. One thing to say is that all this stuff is done based on all the samples that I have in the data, and that is not a unbiased cross-section of all tissues we have and how they're represented in the body and so on. So that's the caveat. One other interesting thing, I think, is that if you look at the number of copies that you clone for a particular microRNA in one sample, if you look at the ones that are low expressed, there's some regularity in the number of copies that you get from these microRNAs. Whereas the ones that are, you know, 10 copies or higher in a sample of something like 1,000 microRNAs, they don't follow this kind of pattern. So I think these sequences here, they're probably just, you pick them up by chance. So there's not, I mean, there are lots of low abundance microRNAs that, in my opinion, are not very relevant for the biology of the tissue. So that's basically that.
You're saying you could probably
only. And I mean, so as I said, these samples are roughly 1,000 sequences. So for those maybe things that are, what is 1%? So microRNAs that are 1% and higher in the sample, I think they probably do something. These ones I don't think. Yes. I didn't want to go to 10 because then you see here that there's maybe, you know, 15 microRNAs that have that.
But
That's what I think, but because, as I said, I don't have an unbiased sampling of the tissues in the body, and this is, you know, a certain sample size, and it varies from tissue to tissue. I didn't want to put strong numbers, but it just sort of gives you the ballpark. Yeah. No, I don't, but that's sort of, so all these things are based on taking the 20 nucleotide fraction from the GL, right? So there, as I said, if you just look at that, also with this protocol that selects for the 5' phosphate, you get maybe 60%, 80% microRNAs. If you don't do the selection based on 5' phosphate, this was a previous protocol that Tom Tuschl used, I remember numbers in the order of maybe, you can go down to 20% that are microRNAs in this size fraction, but in the rest. Okay, how specific is microRNA expression? So what you see here is a whole bunch of microRNAs that are sorted by some measure of tissue specificity. I can tell you precisely what this is later on if you want to. But the point here is that here are the microRNAs that are, you know, you see one particular bar that corresponds to one particular tissue, so we think that these are really tissue-specific microRNAs. But very quickly you end up in this range where a microRNA is expressed across a whole series of tissues. So the message from this is there's not so many microRNAs that are really very tissue specific. There are some. And the reason this is important, so this side of the plot is important, is because people have started to do things like this, to classify cancers based on microRNA profiles. It's much easier to profile 200 microRNAs than to profile 20,000 genes, and people want to use this to type the cancer cells. So what you see, this is from a paper in Nature in 2005. So these are samples that are taken from a whole lot of tissues, which are mentioned here. And the only thing to notice is that there is a reasonably good separation of the samples by tissue. If you just, this is done clustering based on the microRNA expression profile. Now, that works fairly well with tissues. It doesn't work so well anymore if you look at a particular cell type and say, you know, I'm just going to look at B cells, and there's different malignancy, there's different kinds of other patterns. And just to belabor a bit on that, that's a slightly different picture from our study. These are, again, microRNAs. These are samples. And here you can see that there's some fairly good separation. So chronic lymphocytic leukemia, they're all pretty much here. Acute B-cell leukemia is over here. Lymphomas are over here, and so on. So they do, there is some degree of separation, but there's also a fair amount of mix. So what that means, actually, is if you want to do this kind of thing for cells that are very related, you have to have accurate methods to do microRNA profiling. And what I'm showing you here is there's been in the past few years a number of studies that profile, say, brain, the microRNA content of brain. So these are two samples from the previous paper I mentioned. This is another study, then another two samples from another paper, and so on. So these are the ones that Pablo in Tom Tuschl's group has isolated in our study. And what you see here is the Sturman correlation coefficient of the microRNAs that were expressed in both of these, in the two compared studies. So what you can see here, that's the scale. First of all, there's not a great deal of correlation. Now, admittedly, these are different parts of the brain and they're different studies, and they're probably different parts of the brain in all the different studies, but the reviewers asked us to do this, so we've done it, and I wanted to show you this because in the end, I mean, there's not a great deal of correlation in the expression profile that you expect that you get with different methods. And you can maybe explain away some of this with the difference in the samples, but I don't think that that is all there is to it. And another thing to note is that if you take samples in the same study, right? So these are two from this study, these are the ones from Pablo's study, they correlate with each other better than they correlate with, say, you know, cortex in the, what Pablo has sequenced and cortex in what other people have sequenced correlate less than within the study. And we have some other data to actually show downstream that these methods have some intrinsic biases, such that if you do cloning, they tend to pick up some microRNAs preferentially compared to the others. If you do hybridizations on the arrays, they also pick preferentially some and not others. And I really want to, the only reason I'm telling you this is because I think it's important to emphasize that we don't have very precise methods to profile microRNAs. And if you really want to use this for, say, classifying B cells, you have to have that. Yeah.
So,
Yeah, so that was one of the reasons to do this. So I can tell you what Pablo has done, and I think he's really done a very serious and honest effort to do this, but I don't think the problem is settled. So what he's done is he had synthetic microRNA pools, and then he made an artificial sample combining these things. And he knows the relative concentrations in there. And then he did cloning from the pool, right? And then you can try to correlate the cloning frequency with the concentration. And I'm not going to show you this kind of correlation plot because you're going to laugh at me, but I've also done the resampling test to show that it's, I mean, you get correlation coefficients of, say, if you have 6,000 clones, you get a correlation coefficient experiment of 0.99. It's very significant, but it's very low. If I just take that microRNA pool and I sample from it and I say, what kind of correlation do I expect between a sample of this size, I still don't get higher than maybe 0.4 or so. So from just doing the cloning with, because of the small numbers, you expect a relatively low correlation, but it's still lower than what you expect by resampling. So there's bias, and there's also, so we haven't settled the problem. I think it's working reasonably to tell you what are the most frequent microRNAs in the sample. If you look at sort of mid-range and low-range, we get it. So that's where we are. And that's why I put this up, because I think it's really important to know that there are we've done a really serious effort to try to validate our data, but none of these studies actually have done this kind of thing, right? So they show that their method is reproducible, especially the array stuff. They show that the method is reproducible, and it is very reproducible, but it's also biased, and they have not tried to validate their method on some synthetic pool of microRNAs. Okay, another thing you can see from this kind of data is if you have a particular microRNA, so say LET7, and you look at how many times do you see a mature form coming from this arm or a mature form coming from this arm, so this is the distribution. So these are the counts of 3' clones from the same precursor. These are the counts of 5' clones from the same precursor. Each point is a microRNA precursor. Okay. So you probably can see this better in this picture here. The point is that microRNAs intrinsically tend to be to give, so a precursor gives rise to a mature form only from one arm typically. So that's why you have this enrichment on these axes here. And there's not much that is on the diagonal. So there are not many symmetrically processed microRNAs. One notable exception that you can see here is this microRNA 142 that I put on the previous slide. If you ask the question of, I mean, obviously, if you maybe have heard about microRNAs and target predictions and so on, I mean, how should I do with this? Should I just try to tell you, or should I stop? So you can ask the question, the microRNA 5' end, you've heard from me and from other people before, it's important for targeting, right? So then you better have, if you want to have a reliable process, you want to make sure that the 5' end is precisely cut so that you don't have shifts in that region, because if there's some positional information in what genes are targeted. So we ask this question, how precise is the processing at the 5' end of the microRNA? So what you see here is, again, a histogram of the standard deviation of the processing site location. And what you see here is the proportion of clones, or proportion of sequences that use the dominant processing site, right? So as you can see here, there's actually very, the processing is very good. So most of this really happens in one spot. But there is some smear over here. So in the processing of microRNAs, there are these, the cut is not absolutely precise, and that might make some difference to the targeting, maybe not, depends on how frequent these things are relative to the dominant form. And typically, they're rare relative to the dominant form. And to show you how this thing looks like, so here's the LET7 microRNA, is one microRNA that is processed very precisely. And here are all the unique sequences that we've seen, and here are the counts with which we've observed them in the entire data. So as you can see, this, all these sequences, of which is 99.7% of the sequences, they're all processed precisely at the same site. So LET7 is a prototypical microRNA. It really wants to be precisely processed. It must have a clear set of targets. that's not so sure for a whole lot of microRNA. So here's another one, 302. It gives rise to mature forms from both sides of the microRNA stem. And here you can see the counts again. So, you know, again, the dominant form is much more expressed than the others, but there's one sequence here that we've seen 34 times still. And it's not, it misses almost entirely the 5' end of the microRNA that is supposed to be involved in the target. We can also look at things like post-processing modifications, right? Because we have all these clones, we have the precursor sequence, and we can tell where there is a change between the precursor and the observed mature form. And just to give you some ideas of what post-processing modifications occur in microRNAs, these are the most abundant ones that you've seen. So the most abundant, I think, are actually these ones. So at the 3' end of the microRNA, you see U additions or A additions. So that looks like some polymerase activity that adds these non-template nucleotides after the microRNA is cut. There's also some example of what presumably is A to I editing, but these kind of things, as you see, so the total number of modifications is maybe 3 to 4% of the sequences that have these kind of things. They are not very abundant, so they seem to be really as the genome is encoding them. This sort of is in contrast, this relatively low A to I editing that we've observed in this data is, in just a second, sort of to contrast it with one of the viral microRNAs that we found in which most of the sequences were edited. So they had, the genome has an A and the sequence has a G. Yeah. So we've done, this is one example that is done using all the clones. It's also done in a tissue by tissue fashion. So we have, yes. Well, it's not, you see some things that seem to occur preferentially in some tissues, but overall, I don't recall an example in which most of the mature forms that come from that particular microRNA in that particular tissue were edited. I understand that, but even if you look within a tissue, maybe I haven't carefully looked at all these tables. There's like 30 some supplementary tables we have, but I haven't looked if in some particular tissue a microRNA that comes, say, from, I don't know, from 368 in, I don't know, testes, all the sequences are edited. I haven't seen that. Okay. How many microRNAs are there? Okay. Here's the history that's sort of a very sketchy history. So that's the paper that Artemis mentioned before from Chris Burgess' lab, where they made the estimate that no more than, I mean, it was, I don't know who put this statement, but it's very strong, right? So no more than 255 microRNA genes are in the human genome. A lot of people took offense with this, and everybody, I mean, it's a good way to get, I guess, citations, because everybody wants to say there's more microRNA, and look at these guys, they only said 255, right? So the first ones to go sort of overshoot this is for this study in which they've done some prediction and some RNA microRNA validation and some cloning. And the main upshot of this paper is they found a lot of microRNAs, they say, are primate specific and are expressed in things like placenta. So here's the next number. If you want to go all the way to the... okay, so this is a very recent paper. I'm not going to comment on this except to say, you know, tens of thousands of microRNAs. Now this really approaches the number of genes in the gene. The only thing I want to comment on this based on the kind of things that I have analyzed is that if you look at things like the folding, the conservation, the precision of processing, the repetitiveness in the genome and stuff like that, you define some criteria like that. I wasn't very fond of this kind of classification, but there is some information in Tom Tuschel wanted to do it very much. So you define classes of microRNA precursors, and this is the prototypical class, the sort of less seven-like microRNAs. Not as strongly conserved in all kinds of other things, but things like less seven. There are less than 300 microRNA precursors in the human genome, but those give rise to 97% and more of the clones that you've seen in the data. So I'm going to stay on the conservative side. And I think actually I find it quite astounding that this number is really much closer to this than to any of these. Right? Of course, they've done this based on conservation in a whole lot of other species, but I think that was a very good study. Okay, what else can we find in the small RNA data, just very quickly? So as I said, we can annotate a lot of things based on similarity with known stuff. There's, of course, novel microRNAs. Everybody does cloning to find novel microRNAs. And what are the ways to tell a new microRNA? So here's criteria that we use. Of course, we want the sequence to match to the genome, to be cloned multiple times, presumably to be conserved and to have a hairpin precursor. And actually, there is a paper that specifies what should be a microRNA. It's quoted over here. They have very specific criteria that they want to be fulfilled. Typically, they're not completely followed in all the papers that are publishing microRNAs, and I think that's one reason why you see in the database of microRNAs, MIR-based, some things come in, some things come out, and it's because people don't really even follow these rules very strictly. But there's a lot of stuff, a lot. I mean, some percentage of all the things that we clone from these things with 5' phosphate that we don't yet know what they are, and this is what people look for, novel classes of microRNAs. And just to tell you the ones that I've worked on, so this is a paper that in which Tom Tuchel talked about these repeated circular small interfering RNAs was done in flies. These are sequences that are slightly longer than the microRNAs and presumably have something to do with silencing repeats in the fly genome. This one I'll tell you a few words in a minute. So this is a novel class of small RNAs that are specifically expressed in male germ cells. And they also have, I mean, if you look at these things, right, you start separating these things by size. But if you look at like every sort of size class, so 22 is microRNAs, 26 is this, 28 is that. I mean, it's quite amazing actually what you find in these small RNA fractions. Okay, so these things are longer, somewhere between 27 and 30, depending on what stage you isolate them from. And the viral microRNAs that I mentioned before, so the first ones that we found were found experimentally in this paper by Sebastian in Tom Tuchel's group. I should mention all these things are really collaborations with Tom Tuchel's lab. And I'll just end with a couple of words about these piRNAs because they were discovered last year and I think they're interesting for a reason I'll mention. So here's the development of male germ cells. What you see here is the expression of some proteins from the argonaut family. They're Smili and Miwi. So the argonaut family, ARGO2 and ARGO1 and ARGO4, these things are in the RISC complex, right? These things are related to these proteins, and it's not clear what kind of complexes they form. But if you do things like you do IPs, you isolate these things that are bound to these proteins, and you do the cloning, you end up seeing these piRNAs. They're in the range of 27 to 30 nucleotides long, and they kick in precisely at 14 days of mouse development. This is, again, very stunning, right? If you look at 12 days, you look at 14 days, this is when they kick in. They all come in at that stage. And these are basically blots done with two such sequences, one from chromosome 17, one from chromosome 9. So you can see this, that there's a fair amount of them. And that's just to show you the whole population of piRNAs that I showed you in one of the first slides. Now, what is really special about these compared to microRNAs is instead of coming from these hairpin precursors, they seem to come from these very long, and you can see that it's tens of kilobases long transcripts. So if you map these things to the genome, this is the kind of pattern you see, a lot of little sequences that are on the same strand of the genome. And actually, one thing that we found interesting is that there are some cases in which you see this bidirectional promoter that gives rise from one transcript from one strand, another transcript from another strand, and you see piRNAs produced from both. This is their location in the mouse genome, I think, right? And this is to show you that if you isolate different sizes, or if you do the IP, these things sort of scattered, so they seem to be, it's really the same population we're looking at. Yes. So, if you look at how they map to the genome, this is the kind of picture you see. So some of them, there is a bias for better precision at the piRNA end, just as with the microRNAs, and you can see that sort of picture here. But there are cases in which, you know, you have this kind of smear. And if we look at Are there any indications that they come from hairpin precursors? What we've done here, so if you take the pyRNA sequence, you extend it to the left and right, and you do the folding. And then you look at every position in this long precursor, is it paired or not? And you do that over all the pyRNAs, or you do that over all microRNAs. So what you see here is that for microRNAs, here's a mature form. It's typically very strongly paired, and it can either pair with the 5' end or it sort of falls back on this side or on that side. So that's why you see these peaks here. But the point is that the environment of microRNAs, if you take that sequence and you fold it, you get structure. If you do that with the pyRNAs, you extend it to the left and right, it's really nothing you can see. So it doesn't look like these things come from hairpin precursors. They come from this long transcript. There is some bias in where they're processed, but nobody actually knows how they're processed, and nobody really knows what they do. I think there's some ideas that maybe they do something similar to some of the microRNAs in the clearance of transcripts at different stages. Yes? How? In what sense? Well, given that they come from these long transcripts that are tens of kilobases long, it's fall to maybe. Yeah. I don't know if there's been a chip with fall 2 on these things, but unless you assume that there's promoters scattered through this whole region so that fall 3 can produce short transcripts that cover this entire region, I think the most parsimonious explanation is that they're fall 2 transcripts. Okay. I think that's all I had to say. So all the computational work that I talked about here, almost all of the computational work has been done by people in my group in particular. Alain has worked on the viral microRNA predictions. Demos, Jean and Philippe, they're the ones working on mapping, annotations, all kinds of software tools for these things. Mirabella has done the whole database and visualization tools for the small RNA data that I presented to you today. Nick and Rob Sheridan and Stoke Herring. So Rob has done a lot of the annotation of the small RNAs, and Nick has helped with the analysis of the modifications that occur in the microRNAs. Sebastian has thrown a lot of the data. And now in Pantusha's lab, Pablo has done all the comprehensive small RNA cloning. Alex Ray has done the pyRNA study. And of course, none of this would be possible if I didn't get to work with Tom Tuschel, where all the data comes from. So, thank you.